Well, welcome back to our fourth and final grand finale of the book of Shoftim, the book of Judges. And it is a very, very action-packed, complicated, complex, mind-bending, challenging, uncomfortable series of chapters we're going to talk about tonight. So, chapter 16, which is the chapter that closes out the story of Samson, of Shimshon. It's actually, relative to the other chapters, it's actually easier to process. So the beginning of the chapter, we're introduced to Shimshon, to Samson, as he engages with an Isha Zona, a prostitute woman. And we don't really know much about this woman other than she was a prostitute and he had his way with her. And then they tried to catch him. They thought they would get him in the morning, and he got up in the middle of the night and ripped the gates of the city out, you know, showing his strength. And the reason why the commentaries tell us why the book of Judges tells us this story is really to kind of paint a picture, which is a little bit of a conflicting picture. But I'll tell you what the picture is that they say the prophet is trying to paint here. What they say is that the prophet is trying to paint a picture of why, of the beginning of Samson's downfall. So, whereas in the past, last week we read about the story of Shimshon and the woman who he took as his wife, that even though it was driven by lustful temptation, but at the same time, he was driven by a divine calling. There was a mechanism. Here they seem to find fault in Shimshon's going after this prostitute woman and subsequently with Delilah, which again creates a tension because on the one hand, the rabbis are critical. And in fact, we see clearly in the text that he gets punished for what he's doing. But at the same time, the whole thing is a setup because at the end of the day, Shimshon is able to destroy, to kill more of the Plishtim, more of the Philistines in his death, in dying, than he did in all of the years of being alive. So if this whole thing was about this kind of master game plan, this master manipulation in order for him to get to this point where he could defend the people and take out the Philistines, so while he on the one hand was driven by this kind of lustful temptation, but at the end of the day, it was part of Hashem's master plan. So I guess what I would say is like this. They're both true. You can't really, they're not mutually exclusive concepts. On the one hand, Shimshon was driven by human desire. And in fact, according to, as we mentioned last week, and I read again in the commentaries on these verses, it wasn't just average, you know, male sexual desire. There was like he was supercharged, which puts us into a place where we want to be careful about judging because we can't necessarily know what that energy might be like. And he's held accountable for his temptation, but at the same time, Hashem orchestrated things in such a way that ultimately, he was able to be victorious and really do away with a lot of the Philistines. Does that make sense? I'm not saying that's an easy pill to swallow, but it's understandable as opposed to some of the other stories which are really, really hard to understand. We could understand that, you know. So we're going to talk about that in a little bit. It's a very good point. And we have to put that in the context because martyrdom actually has some halachic issues when we look at it correctly. And we'll talk about that. So that's a good point. Well, we'll get to that when we get to the end of the chapter. Okay, so, you know the famous, I've shared this multiple times, a story in the Talmud, that at a certain point, the rabbis gathered in Jerusalem and asked God to remove the temptation for idol worship. And they prayed, and the next morning, the desire for idol worship had gone away. Rabbis gathered again and said, okay, it worked the first time. Let's ask God to take away the temptation for murder. Again, these two things are things that we don't really... idol worship is even more foreign to us than murder. Because there may have been a time in your life that you may have wanted to kill someone. I mean, maybe not actually thought about where you were going to get the gun or knife to do it. But you might have been angry at someone enough that you might have... I hope you didn't actually think that you would kill them, but like, I really want to kill that person. Like, at least even say that, but you never get like this sudden urge, like, I'm having a really rough day. I need to go bow down to an idol. It's not something like, it's just so foreign to us. And it's not commonplace in society, whereas murder, unfortunately, is still something that is the norm on some level. I mean, it's not normal. That's why we have prisons and so on, but the idea of people murdering each other is not completely foreign. But nonetheless, in the times, if you read, as we're going to read in the subsequent books during the times of the kings, even to some extent what we read here, although most of the murder here, we shouldn't call it murder, most of the death that we've been reading is in the context of war, there's a lot of murder that we read about in the books of the kings and during that era. So the rabbis went and prayed to have the desire for murder removed. And they woke up the next morning and it worked. Well, they said, 2 for 3, let's go for the third one. So they gathered again and said, you know, they asked God to remove the temptation for illicit relationships. And the Talmud says they woke up the next morning, there wasn't an egg to be found in all of Jerusalem. So they realized that we can't do away with that one. So there is something about sexual desire that's extremely powerful. In many ways, even more powerful and obviously necessary, more than the other two big ones. And just putting that in context, that we have Shimshon, who his whole story is driven by sexual desire. It's just an interesting point. Yeah, go ahead.
No, and it's that whole idea that you really need Yetzirah to, you know, I mean, there would be no world without it.
Right. There needs to be, well, there would be no purpose. And procreation is part of the purpose of progenitating the generations, or however you say that. So the reality is that in temptation, there's holiness and there's unholiness, and there's neutrality. And here we see an extreme, intense temptation that maybe was used out in an unholy way, but it's a very powerful force, as you said. So now that Shimshon is enticed by this woman, Delilah, she begins to play this game with him where she tries to gather information. Where does his strength come from? And the real underlying question that she was trying to discern on behalf of the king and the people there was to understand where does this strength come from? Is this a physical strength? Is this a natural strength? Or is this a supernatural strength? In other words, if it's a natural strength, then is it possible to overcome it? That's a, you know, it's a military strategy. You have an extremely powerful enemy. In this case, in the embodiment of an individual, can that be overpowered? If it's a supernatural strength, where's the source of that strength? And can that be in some manner circumvented? Can we turn off the power? So one time, two times, he tells her what to do, and he's playing with her to try to brush her off, and she doesn't let go. And finally, he reveals his secret to her. And of course, he tells her that the secret is his long hair. But really, it's not the here that's the magic here. And that's why if you look in the verses, chapter 16, verse 17, he says, a razor has never come upon my head, for I am a Nazarite of God from my mother's womb. If I am shaved, my strength will leave me. I'll become weakened like all men. Now, it's not about his hair being cut that eliminates his strength. It's that he's following God's instruction. And as long as he's following God's instruction, he is, remember, by the way, that no one really knew, except for him and his mother, the framework of his responsibility here. And this is the first time he's revealing it to anybody else. Even his father didn't know what this was really all about. So now he's revealing this, and in turn, by having his hair cut, combined with the sin of sinning with this woman, it went downhill very fast. And indeed, they came and they took him and they arrested him. And as a punishment for... So after she cut his hair, he wakes up and he doesn't realize that his strength is tied to his hair. And he doesn't realize that his hair has been shorn, or he doesn't realize that his strength is gone. So he goes out and immediately he's caught and they gouge out his eyes. And his eyes were, you know, we say in the Shema, you shouldn't turn after your heart and after your eyes. It says that the eyes are the seducer. The eye sees, the heart desires, and then the body acts. So being careful with what we look at is the first step in protecting ourselves from going down that slippery slope. So as a result of him looking where he shouldn't and allowing his eyes to tempt him, he had his eyes gouged out. We read an interesting thing in verse 21. And after they gouged out his eyes, they brought him to Gaza. They bound him with brass chains and made him grind in the prison. What is this grinding that he's doing? So there are two opinions. One is, it was commonplace to put prisoners to do heavy labor. And in those days, the heaviest labor was the mill grinding. Right? It was hard work, and so who better to do it than the prisoners? But there's another, the grinding, according to some of the commentaries, is a euphemism. And the euphemism is for grinding in another way to procreate. That they thought that his strength was physical strength and figured that therefore his genes must be really strong. And if he impregnated a bunch of women, the children, they'd have a whole army of powerful Samsons. Again, of course, that it wasn't physical strength, it was spiritual strength, and it didn't do much for them. The Philistines gathered in their Colosseum of sorts to celebrate their victory over Samson. And in doing so, they made him dance, which itself was an act of humiliating him. And they also poked fun at God. So as much as Shimshon was humiliated that he was this mighty warrior that was now in their hands, they're making fun of him by making him dance. And finally, poking fun at God when his hands are tied, so to speak, is probably the worst of all of that. And we understand also that in what's going on here, Shimshon is doing teshuvah. He's repenting for what he has done wrong. He recognizes that. And now we come to Lali's question. He asks to lean on the pillars. And of course, he turns to God and asks for one more time to have this inner strength to manifest itself so that he can take revenge. And indeed, he is successful at bringing down the whole Colosseum and killing more people, as it says, in his dying than he did while he was alive. So how is he allowed to do this? So let's put a few things in context. First of all, martyrdom in Judaism is not modern day Islamic martyrdom, but there is a concept of Jewish martyrdom. Now, Jewish martyrdom is in the context of dying for the sake of Hashem's name. What we have today is a little bit of a different kind of martyrdom, and that's the martyrdom of killing others while risking your life in God's name. That's when you talk about suicide bombers or people who blow up planes and stuff like that. Their idea is that they're prepared to die in the process of taking out other people. Conceptually and historically, a Jew is never allowed to take another life in the context of God's name. In fact, so much so that if there were to be a situation where the enemy comes and says, give us a Jew and we won't kill the rest of you, you're not allowed to, everybody needs to be killed, you're not allowed to give one person up. Right? So that's how much you're not allowed to take another person's life, even when it's at the possibility of saving a whole community. So, but the idea of martyrdom, it's called dying al Kiddush Hashem. Kiddush Hashem means sanctification of God's name. And the idea of being challenged to deny your faith or to give up your life, Judaism says you have to give up your life. To give up your life and not deny God. You have to give up your life and not worship idols. You have to give up your life and not take another's life. These are the framework through which one is allowed to give up their lives. Any other sin, you're not allowed to give up your life as a general rule. There are exclusions to the rule. What we know in tradition as a time of shmad, a time of decree, when there's a decree against the Jewish people, it's brought down in the Talmud, it's brought down in the code of Jewish law, that even if they ask you to change the color of your shoelace so that you will be consistent with the style of the time, if it's a time of decree against the Jewish people, you're not allowed to do that. In other words, you're not even allowed to move the law a tiny bit. We have in the story of Hanukkah, where they asked the Maccabees to symbolically eat food that would be, they would pretend is not kosher, and they would pretend is not kosher, so that the other people would see, and in seeing the Maccabees eating of this food, they would assume that eating of the food is permissible. The food wouldn't be not kosher. The food is kosher. But they would perceive it as being not kosher because that's how it would be presented. And they told them that Talmud says you're not allowed to do that. And they gave up their lives. So martyrdom in that context is that clarifies a little bit martyrdom. Now, here, Shimshon was, again, remember, following God's instruction, number one. Number two, his job was to take out as many Philistines. That was God's instruction. In other words, we don't have, in today's day and age, if God tells you to go and take out other people, you got to get your head checked out, because we don't do that anymore, and God doesn't speak to us. The Talmud says the prophecy ended. So we don't have that kind of divine communication. But in the times when there was judges and there was communication from God, this was instruction from God. Further, he was taking vengeance on behalf of God, on behalf of himself, on behalf of the Jewish people, all of which were permitted and necessary. Now, still begs the question, it's one thing to take vengeance and risk your life in that process, but are you allowed to take vengeance and know you're going to die? In other words, you're essentially killing yourself, you're committing suicide in this act of taking out others. So, the answer to this, then, the commentaries address this very question, is they say a couple of things. Number one, Shimshon understood that his life was at its end. It was only a matter of time before the Philistines were going to kill him. And it could also be that he had divine intuition that this was the day he was to die. In other words, he understood from God that this was it. So if he's going out, he might as well go out and take others with him in that process. And as such, again, we see that he was successful. So he was successful at both dying and taking out others with him. And just the chapter closes out that they allowed for him to, they allowed his body to be buried. There was a respect for that, for whatever that's worth. And that Shimshon, so we see at the end of the chapter, we read that he judged Israel for 20 years. So this is a very, very interesting verse. He's dead. So what, how's he judging Israel if he's no longer alive? So that one commentary says that it's not really a reference to him post-mortem. It's talking about, it's kind of like a recap. That you want to know how long he ruled for? He was a judge for 20 years in total. That's the period of his rule. But there's a very interesting commentary that actually says that he ruled for 20 years in his life, and the fear of Shimshon and his influence lasted for 20 years after his death. And the Rebbe in 1951 and the subsequent years would oftentimes talk about the previous Rebbe in the context that his influence lasted for 20 years. The previous Rebbe's discourse that he wrote prior to his passing, that became, so to speak, his last will and testament, was comprised of 20 chapters. And the Rebbe delivered a discourse for 20 years on each year on one of the 20 chapters. When the 20 years ended, the Rebbe then said that the influence now kind of repeats itself for another 20 years, and the Rebbe subsequently continued until 1987. The Rebbe continued right before the Rebbetzin's passing, the Rebbe continued to deliver each year a discourse on one chapter, the corresponding chapter of the previous Rebbe's discourse. But this idea is really drawn from this concept that, according to those commentaries, that these words at the end of the chapter that he ruled for 20 years means after his death, his influence continued for an additional 20 years. Questions? In what format did they kill themselves?
I mean, you know, I've read stories of people that have, you know, literally killed their whole family. I mean, just...
They were asking them, like...
To convert.
Do you believe in what we believe in?
Well, let's put it in context. If... I'm going to answer your question, but we have to put these stories in context. There's a difference, A, if somebody says... you know, you have the story of Hannah and her seven sons, right? And the story of Hanukkah, right? Again, the same concept. Bow down or we're going to kill you. The answer is, you're going to kill me because I'm not going to bow down. So we may pretend that we're Christians on the outside and keep Passover in the basement of our houses, but when we get caught, we're not going to deny who we are. Is that an acceptable martyrdom? It's obligatory martyrdom. In fact, the time that one is living externally as a Christian is the period of time that's questionable, and that's why they were called Maranos by many. Again, we're not sitting here in judgment, but putting it in context. Now, what happens when you're in that basement celebrating the Passover Seder and the Inquisition comes? They're going to kill you. So is it appropriate to take your own life? It becomes a complicated question. We have a famous story during the Holocaust where a woman and her whole school took cyanide and killed themselves in advance. The Nazis had them, but they were going to be violated. They knew that they were going to be violated, so they took their lives, which was an act of self-sacrifice to prevent themselves from being violated. If there wasn't that concern, then one could argue that maybe they should have let the Nazis kill them instead of killing themselves. But that becomes a question when you know that when the person knows that they're going to be killed with certainty. And again, every situation would require, how do you know with certainty, right? You know, Shimshon, they weren't letting him go. His strength was gone. And he was going to die. There wasn't a question about it. It was only a question of timing, at least from that angle. Forget about the divine intuition in this moment. So in such an instance, there may very well be an appropriateness to taking your own life and not letting the enemy kill you. But conversely, it may be just as appropriate to go the other way. So each situation has to be understood. But we have the general guidelines are there, and none of us should ever be challenged. All right, let's move on. So now we enter into chapter 17, the last chapters of the book of Judges, and we're going to talk about three stories. I'm going to give a general introduction, then we'll go into the stories. The first story is the story of Micha. It's known as Pesel Micha, the Pesel means an image of Micha, which was the idol of Micha that had a very powerful influence on the Jewish people. We have the story of the conquering of Laish, the city, and we have what's known as Pelegish Begiva, one of the saddest stories in Jewish history, the concubine of Giva. Now, when did these stories happen? It's a little bit, the sequencing of these stories in the context of the last 17 chapters, the last 16 chapters, kind of is a little bit out of, it's a little bit out of place. It doesn't flow. In other words, we read, each judge comes along, there's a story that goes with it, a judge comes along, a story goes along with it, and these chapters, there's no judge, there's no leader. There's a certain lawlessness that seems to take place in all of these stories. So when did these stories take place? Now, there's other factors in these stories that create tension between letting us believe that these stories took place at the beginning of the Jewish people's conquest in the land of Israel, or perhaps in the beginning of the era of the judges, maybe after the death of Joshua. And there are other details here that seem to indicate that it specifically took place at the end, such as the final verse of this section, which reads, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Each person did what was right in his eyes." And then when we open up the book of Shmuel, the book of Samuel, this seems like a perfect prelude. In other words, there was no king in Israel, a.k.a. leader, judge, any kind of spiritual guide, any kind of leadership, and therefore there was a vacuum. And then along comes Eli, the high priest, then we have the subsequent story. In other words, there was something missing, and along came this kind of answer to the question. In other words, we didn't go from Samson straight into that. We had these other eras in between. But here's a real doozy for you. Who was Micha? And we start off calling him Michayahu. So here's a real crazy one for you. I shouldn't say that. It's Torah. But it's, I remember hearing this as a child, and it's a fascinating story. So Moses comes to God and says, what's going on with your people here? Your people are dying. Pharaoh's killing these children. He's cementing them into the walls of these cities that the Jews are building. And he says, why have you done bad to your people? So God says, I have a master plan. And to show you, this is really painful to even say this, but this is what the Medrash says, that there's a reason why these children specifically are being the ones put into the walls. And you can pick one. So he goes and he takes Micha out of the wall. And Micha ultimately becomes a negative influence on, what's the name of the priest? Remember the name of the priest? Yonasan. Look in chapter 18, verse 30. Yonasan ben Gershom ben Menashe. Now, I don't know how it's written in your text there, but you may... Chapter 18, verse 30, you have it there?
Yeah, it says Jonathan, son of Gershom.
How's Menashe spelled there?
In English?
No, in Hebrew. You see the word Menashe there?
Hold on, I'll find it. Yeah, it's got the nun.
So show Lolly.
Right here.
You see it, Raphael?
I'm on page 89.
What page are you on?
Yeah, I'm on page
89, and I see that chapter 18 only goes up to 28. What am I? Oh, I'm in Yeshua.
So the nun is raised. Now, if you take the nun out of Menashe, what does it become?
Moshe.
So Yonasan is the son of Gershom. And we know that Gershom was one of Moshe's sons. So this is Moshe's grandson. So Moshe's grandson is influenced by... And we know that because he's called from the tribe of Levi, right? He's a Levite. He says he came from Judah, but he's from the tribe of Levi. And they respected him because he was a Levite, meaning he came from the priestly family. Right? So out of respect for Moshe, the prophet switches it up and puts it as Menashe.
Okay, so wait a minute. I got to describe it. All right, so Gershom was a son of Moshe. And so therefore, this Jonathan was a grandson of Moshe.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, what happened with Micha? So Micha was hanging around when the Jewish people were leaving Egypt. And he saw how Moses comes to the Nile to bring up the coffin of Joseph that the Egyptians had sunk to the bottom of the Nile. Remember that story? Prior to when Joseph died, they sunk the coffin to the bottom of the Nile because they knew that as long as Joseph was in Egypt, the Jewish people would be enslaved. So they kept him there. And Joseph had brought them blessing and so on and so forth. So how do you get a coffin that's whatever they had there, whatever steel coffin they had, sunk to the bottom? So Moshe took a piece of, I think it was gold foil, and he wrote on it, Ale Shor, rise up, ox. And he threw the foil into the water, and it went underneath the coffin, and it brought the coffin up. At that point, Moshe takes the coffin, gets busy with the coffin. What happens to the piece of gold foil? So Micha comes and takes it. When they made the golden calf, when everybody's gathering the gold, Micha comes along and flips the golden foil into the fire with the gold. And as a result of it, because it said on that foil, Ale Shor, rise up ox, so a calf rose up in that fire.
Such a great
Midrash. Huh?
Such a great Midrash.
So now you have Micha who's already instigating idol worship, right? Okay, what the story is really all about, I'm going to leave to the Midrashic experts. But according to this understanding, which is supported because you have in the text there, this elevated nun, we have clearly that Yonasan, Jonathan, is a descendant. He's a recent descendant of Moses, which could not have been 300 years later. People didn't live that long then. So these stories must have taken place in the earlier part. So we have one of two kind of explanations. They both work. One is that indeed these stories are located at the beginning of this era, and there's evidence to support that, or these stories are at the end, or maybe somewhere in between. But regardless, the reason why they're put here is because they're not part of the regular narrative. They're important stories to show. There are important lessons to draw from these stories. I'll just give you one more important, just to put it in context. At the end of this chapter, it talks about, let's see, where is it? Matek, if you don't mind, Matek. Where is it here? I think maybe it's in the next chapter. Talk about this worship of this idol lasted. Let me find it. Hold on 1 second here.
Well, you're looking. If I'm not distracting you, tell me.
You're not. Go ahead.
So this idea then is that. This suggests the fact that Jonathan is the son of Gershom, who is Moshe's grandson, that this all happened probably at the end or the beginning of Judges or the end of Joshua. And because they're not part of the narrative, they're added at the end of Judges. But this whole, and that makes perfect sense too, because if that foil or whatever was thrown into burning, I mean, you know, you're talking about while they're still in the desert,
right?
You know, I mean, you're talking about literally, you know, at the beginning of their journey in the desert. So that makes sense then, if the Midrash is trying to support the timeline.
Right. Here's the other verse. So this at the end of chapter 18, it says, then the children of Dan set up the idol for themselves in Jonathan ben Gershom by Manasseh. He and his sons were priests for the tribe of Dan till the day of the exile of the land. They set up for themselves the idol of Micha that they made all the days that the house of God was in Shiloh. Now, the house in Shiloh is going to be destroyed shortly after the story of Eli, which we're going to read in the beginning of the book of Samuel, right? So if these stories took place right prior to that, this is a little bit of a dramatic statement, a little bit of a drama here. It lasted all the days of the house of Shiloh, what, for 50 years? That's a little bit overstated. In other words, if this happened at the beginning, the house of Shiloh stood for 300 and some odd years. If this happened at the beginning, then we understand. It stood all the days of the house the house of Shiloh stood, which itself is a discussion which we'll talk about in a few moments. Like, why? How did this thing stand all the days, you know, all these hundreds of years when you had all these judges? Which is why some commentaries take the opposite approach, that maybe the verse is being dramatic, because it doesn't make sense that you would have all these prophets, all these judges, and they would let the house, a house of idol worship, stand throughout the period of time with all of the oppression that the Jews had, that they would have let it stand. Yet, on the other hand, the verse seems to make some kind of dramatic statement which would make sense to put it in context that it was standing all the years. So you have this tension. And therefore, I like the way you just put it, Karen, that it doesn't fit into the narrative. These are three stories that are connected to each other, revolving around this worship of this idol. In other words, the idol of Micha, the influence on the people of Laish, and as we'll talk soon about the people of Binyamin, and how they were, a lot of this was an influence from this idol. These are three stories that are interconnected, but they don't fit the narrative of the judges. So therefore, they were put at the end. We finish the narrative, and we're going to go back and tell you these stories. Now, when exactly they happen, not really that important at the end of the day. But they're situated here, not specifically because they happened here, because they just as likely could have happened at the beginning of the book, but they're situated here because we don't want to confuse the narrative. We want to be able to read through it properly. So it's just a context to understand where these chapters are located, where these stories are located.
I have a question.
Sure.
Probably kind of tangential, but there are all these 12 tribes, and then a lot of the idols coincide. Like, there are also 12 zodiac signs. I don't really know that much about the zodiac because I don't really subscribe to it. Or whatever, but there a lot of the idols. I mean, I heard of a theory that a lot of the idols were coincided with zodiac signs, like the ram and Yom Kippur was like the era of the ram, which was like a zodiac sign. They were leaving the era of the calf, which is a zodiac sign, right before the ram. And I don't know. I mean, it probably isn't even a question. It's just kind of like, there's something there. I don't know. I mean, I'm confused about the number 12 and like if Judaism has any, like, I mean, I would say it doesn't have a connection to the zodiac, but they're also like 12 months. I don't know. I'm just.
So let me give you some context. Yeah. So Judaism, if you open up Maimonides' books. At the very beginning chapters, Maimonides talks about both spiritual and physical structure of the universe. He talks about the planets, he talks about the galaxies, he talks about the zodiacs. Maimonides has a whole series of chapters talking about the cycle of the moon and the relationship to the zodiacs around them. So the concept is well-rooted in Judaism. There is something called a mazel. Mazel means a zodiac. And we are influenced by the zodiacs. Where we are not influenced, as the Talmud says, "Ein mazel liYisrael." We are not subject to the zodiacs. In other words, we're influenced by it, but we're not subject to it. So when you open the newspaper and see that you belong to a particular zodiac, and therefore you're going to be a monster, or you're going to find love today, or whatever else it is, none of that's true. But it's not. We're not. It's not entirely. It's not entirely irrelevant either. And in fact, you spark a point here that's also fascinating. Like, why would people, even the Micha himself, and the prophet, this Levite who's serving as the priest on behalf of this idol, they were both fundamentally believers in God. And they knew that this thing was not authentic. And yet we see that they're influenced by it. And the reason is because, according to one of the Midrashim, these idols were built in line with certain constellations that actually caused them to have the power to speak. So it was drawing on supernatural sources, which created the impression that they were independent divine beings, where in truth they were just manifestations of a higher divine being. But that was enough for them to question maybe there was a power there, and to influence others to think that there was some value there.
Wasn't it in the last Torah portion that, like, cows were speaking? I don't know. Either that or I just was having a weird moment. Yeah, there are definitely cows. Okay, I don't want to, like, keep you from speaking fast, but that was weird. The speaking cows. I swear,
I'm not familiar with that one.
I don't know.
In the Leviticus?
In the last, yeah.
Last Shabbos?
Yeah, it was like, go to the Kila, and I, like, they were like, the cows were speaking. And I was just like, I kind of rolled my eyes, you know? But
I want to have whatever they were having, that's
for
sure.
I know. Really.
In Shul, the cows were speaking, no less. Okay, go ahead, Karen, what's your question?
Idea of these idols in Shiloh. There was a reference to Shiloh, I believe, with Yaakov's blessing. It was one of the blessings. In other words, I've read. Okay, rather than say something wrong, I've read that Shiloh has been at times associated with Mashiach, and that it was in a blessing given by one of our patriarchs, that there is the mention of Shiloh. It's like that's the only time in the five books that Shiloh's mentioned.
Yeah, I know what you're referring to, but why are you bringing that into the discussion here?
I'm just wondering why this card, you know, it's interesting that we have
House of God and Shiloh.
This house of God, you know, this idol worshiping taking place in Shiloh.
Well, it's not taking place in Shiloh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's not it's what it does is it tells us that it operated all the time. They set up themselves the idol of Micha that he had made all the days that the house of God was in Shiloh.
Okay.
In other words, it ran. The point that the prophet is trying to say is that it was functional as long as the Mishkan was functional. Yeah. Yeah. So let's peruse the story here. We already covered some of the main points, the idea of who was Micha and what was the nature of this idol. So again, we have this interesting story of this money that his mother is concerned about and ends up becoming this idol. Again, what we see here really is kind of an evolution of... We have an evolution of that of this. People don't go from being regular, upstanding believers in God to idol worshippers. The Midrash tells us that the evil inclination is very, very wily. Is that the right word? It's very wily. And Hayom Omer Le'aseh, like Aseh Kach, today the evil inclination says, do this. Then tomorrow he says, do this. And then slowly, slowly, we go down a slippery slope. People don't wake up one morning and become bad people. People don't wake up one morning and become antagonists to God. They don't just wake up one morning and throw out their whole belief system. It's an evolution. So here, Micha is setting up this idol worship to kind of accommodate his mother. But he himself doesn't necessarily believe it. And then you have Yonasan, Jonathan, who comes along and is actually discouraging people from worshiping it. But he's got to make a living, right? Business is business, as the saying goes. So he's got to collect food items and so on. He's got to pay the bills. But it's not sincere. But then when they come and take the idol away and they schlep him along with them, it's like this is an opportunity. So it might as well go along. And then as time evolves, it becomes more of a belief than just kind of an external practice. And the same thing is true with us. You know, we start thinking about what's going on in our own kind of little world and how we evolve in both directions. You know, you get into a bad habit of something, and at first you know you're doing something wrong, but you kind of like, you know, you whitewash it a little bit. You give yourself a pass. Then you do it again, you give yourself another pass. But then you stop giving yourself a pass. Now you start saying it's actually okay. You've shifted your thinking about it from being something that's just giving yourself an excuse or justification to now it's actually an okay practice, right? By the way, we do this in society as a whole, right? Society, it puts up a fight when there's like a new moda in society, and there's fights and there's demonstrations, there's antagonistic stuff, and then it kind of takes root. And people like forget and people move on because it's like, how long are you going to fight something? And then it becomes part of society, right? You know, we've all heard our parents say this, or we've said it to our children. It's like, you know, we would never have gotten away with that, right? What does that mean? That means that 20 years ago, 50 years ago, society was not accepting of that. And now it's acceptable. Now, some of those things might be good that society's come to accept, but some of them aren't. But you can't fight it anymore because society's accepted it, and it's difficult to fight it. So what we're learning from these stories is that you gotta stop these things at the beginning. We gotta redirect our practice from the beginning to make sure that we're on the right track from the very beginning. So the Levite was recruited to serve as the priest in this house of worship for this idol of Micha. That was in chapter 17. In chapter 18, we have the tribe of Dan. Let's talk a little bit about Dan. So the tribe of Dan is an interesting tribe. Dan is known as Ma'asif al-Chol HaMachnes. They were the last of the tribes to travel. They were the stragglers, and that's a loaded word. They were stragglers because they kind of weren't the greatest scholars. They weren't necessarily the great sages of the Jewish people. But on the other hand, they had a great responsibility. They were stragglers, and they collected the leftover items. They collected the stragglers that lagged behind the rest of the people. So the tribe of Dan, one of two things happened. Either they had conquered at the end of they were the last to conquer their portion, or they had conquered it and they lost their portion to an enemy, and they needed land. So they were used to being nomads, and they sent out some spies to kind of figure out where they can go and conquer land. And these five spies ended up in Micha's house. And when they get there, they are encouraged by this Levite to worship. They ask the Levite if they'll be successful, and they seem to get the answer they're looking from, you know, for the answer they're looking for from this Levite. Well, when they head out to go engage in their conquering, they recruit the Levite and the idol with them. And Micha comes out after them, but they intimidate him to return, and it seems like Micha kind of chickens out. So what happens here is this idol now has been relocated, the priest has been relocated, has joined the people of Dan. Now the people of Dan now have this kind of idol that they have to support them, they have the priest to support them, and they go and conquer this city of Laish. Now Laish was not a Jewish city, but the people there were faithful to God. They had rejected idolatry. The tribe of Dan did not ask for peace, which is a basic Jewish practice, that before you attack a city, you offer your hand in peace. And this is considered a negative event that they engaged in here. That they were murderous, unnecessarily. So, again, it's a black stain on the Jewish people. It's a story that's not a pleasant one, but important to identify. And that brings us to chapter 19. Chapter 19 begins the painful story of the concubine in Giva. So, we've had in the recent chapters, and earlier in the book of Judges, we've had a number of stories about very powerful and influential, in a positive way, of Jewish women, right? Who can remember some of their names?
Jewish women.
Yep. In the book of Joshua.
Oh, in the book of Joshua.
I mean, the book of Judges. Devorah, Yael, two more. You can tell me the context of who they were. One is a short story, the story of Achsa, the daughter of Caleb, right?
And the one, the daughter of, that ends up being spending the rest of her life up in the...
Daughter of Yiftach.
Yes, yes.
Right?
Yes.
So these are righteous women. Yes. Now, at the end of the book here, we have a lot of unrighteous women that have very powerful negative influences. Unfortunately, they're not all not Jewish, right? We have the three women of Shimshon, and we have over here this very interesting story of this concubine. Now, to be fair, we really don't have anything much about her that paints her as a bad person. She just is the instigator. She's a victim and also in a certain way kind of the catalyst. Let's put it that way. She's a catalyst for what happens here. Let's understand what a concubine is. Okay, it's again something that's completely foreign to our thinking today, primarily because, especially in Jewish practice, for over 1,000 years, also fascinating story of Jewish history, Rabbeinu Gershom, who had a wife and then had a second wife who ended up creating a lot of strife for him and for his first wife and for the Jewish people. She fell in love with a non-Jewish leader and tricked her own husband, and a whole long complicated story. But as a result of that, Rabbeinu Gershom made a decree. And in his decree, he outlawed, there were many, many decrees that he had made. He was a very powerful Jewish leader, and the Jewish people needed, Jewish law needed some fine-tuning. Certain things needed to be put in place to kind of strengthen Jewish practice. And he established laws. He specifically put a timeline on his laws because he didn't want them to be regarded either as rabbinic law or as Torah law. But they were embraced by the majority of the Ashkenazic Jewish world. One of them was the prohibition against marrying two women. So technically that decree has expired. You don't see Jewish men lining up trying to pick up a second wife. But at the time, definitely in biblical times, it was commonplace for a man to have multiple wives. And it was commonplace for a man to have what they call a concubine. And a concubine I think we can put it pretty bluntly. Purpose of a concubine was for pleasure. It wasn't really for producing children. It wasn't really for the typical, you know, wifely duties. It was really more about, you know, to address the sexual needs. Now, it wasn't completely base, because these women were protected. They were given, they had, according to many opinions, they had the same kind of framework surrounding responsibilities that a husband had to a wife that's outlined in the ketubah. They did not have the security of a get, which means that in Jewish law, if a man gives his wife a get, if a man divorces his wife, he has financial obligations. These women did not get those privileges. So the concept was not completely foreign to Jewish practice of the time. And as such, he had this woman, this man of the tribe of Levi, had a woman who was his pilegesh, was his concubine. And she left him. Again, why did she leave him? So some commentators say that she committed adultery, and she was obligated not to commit adultery because she was essentially a wife. And there are some factors, again, in the text that kind of contradict this. Because if she truly had committed adultery, then by Jewish law, she's no longer his wife. He still has to give her a get, but he has no longer any obligations to her. And some of the story that we see here is where had a sense of obligation towards her. Not only that, but by Jewish law, if a woman commits adultery, husband's not allowed. He's no longer allowed to be with that woman. It's interesting laws how we deal with it in modern times, but fundamentally, when a woman commits adultery, she's no longer allowed to be with that husband. So here, if she committed adultery, why is he going back to her and trying to bring her back? Which he ultimately does, right? He's taking her back to his house. So therefore, the other commentators kind of see this not as that she committed adultery, but she just kind of, she ticked him off. And he got angry at her. And the Talmud talks about this and says, what did she do? What did she do to anger him? So one says that he found a fly in his soup. One says that she found a hair in his soup. And, you know, neither of which are particularly pleasant, but they're not grounds for divorce. And so what we understand also, a very powerful lesson, is that he was a hothead. He had a short temper. And clearly was not a very nice guy, as we'll see from the story. So he got angry at her, screamed at her, berated her, and she went home. I don't need this. I don't need this in my life. This Levite. So she goes home, and eventually he goes back after her. His father-in-law is playing the shtick with him. Stay, stay, just one more day, just eat another meal, just drink some wine, and so on. All very interesting commentaries. Until finally he says, enough. You know, if we're going to play your game, I'm never going to leave here. So he picks up and he starts heading back. He comes to Jebus, yeah. Looking for the Hebrew word on this. Yevus. Now, we understand Jebus or Yevus to be part of Jerusalem. It's actually Jerusalem, but it's a portion of Jerusalem. Again, this is another one of those pieces in the story that kind of create like a question mark. Because we know that at a certain point, Jerusalem was conquered. So if this was Jerusalem, it must have happened early on when Jerusalem had not yet been conquered. Conversely, however, there are opinions that say that even though Jerusalem was conquered, there were parts of Jerusalem that had not been conquered and remained under the rule of the Jebusites until King David came along and conquered them. So it can go either way. It's not a solid proof one way or the other. But regardless, it comes to this area. And what happens at this point is that the Levite says, let's keep on going to Givah, because, you know, They may not be the nicest people, but at least they're Jews. And they'll be good to us. Here, we don't know how they'll treat us. They're non-Jews, they're Jebusites, and so on. So they go. And when they get to Giva, the sun sets, and no one's inviting them in. Now we're gonna talk about this idea. We're gonna talk about it actually right now. What's the basis? This whole story is such a terrible story. What's really going on here? And it smells of another story that we read back in the five books of Moses. They're not very hospitable people, these people of Giva, these Benjaminites. Reminds us of a story of people in Sodom and Gomorrah, right, that were not very hospitable either. Now, these are Jews, and hospitality is a trait of our forefather Abraham that ought to be ingrained in all Jews. So this lack of hospitality is very contrary. Even we just read about Micha, who was this instigator of idol worship. He was one of the reasons that everybody knew about Micha was because he was a very hospitable person. People were traveling. They knew they'd get a hot meal and a warm bed in Micha's place. These people are not acting that way. And when this old man comes along and says, hey, you guys don't really want to hang out here. This is not your place. These are, you know, come to my house. I'll take care of you because these people are not going to be really good. So they come to his house and the people gather on the house of this old man. And they ask him to give out the Levite so they can engage in homosexual behavior with him. Also, just like we read in the story of Sodom, right? Then the angels came, so the people gathered and they said, give us these men. And what does Lot respond? I've got daughters. What do you need my men for? These are guests. Don't touch my guests. They came to my house that way. Here, have my daughters. So at first glance, that's really ugly. Right? That's really ugly. You have a guest, and instead of, granted, you know, it's not nice what they want to do, but you're going to give up your own daughter? That's one way to look at it. And we'll talk about this Sodom parallel in a minute. But there is another way to look at it. And it's also a little bit hard to swallow, but I'm telling you what the commentators tell us. That sodomy is a biblical prohibition, which the Torah has, you know, some really harsh descriptors for. Having relations with a virgin or a non-married woman, while it is not, while it is, the Torah is not in favor of it, is not fundamentally a terrible biblical prohibition. In other words, what we're talking about is having relations out of the context of marriage. This is not she's not married to another woman. At least he's talking about his own daughter. There is a place for that, conceptually. So in terms of sins, that's actually a lesser sin than the sin of this Levite being sodomized by the crowd there. But what we also see is that they never really intended to have their way with the Levite. They anyway wanted the woman. And that's why they ultimately had their way with her. So let's talk for a minute just the distinction between Sodom and what's going on here. Even though the outcome of this is terrible, but from God's vantage point, God didn't engage in a direct way as he did with Sodom, where he overturned the city. And there's a simple reason. There's one stark distinction between Sodom and here, and that is that in Sodom it was institutionalized, here it wasn't institutionalized. In other words, the people of Sodom were, what the practice of Sodom and Gomorrah was institutionalized, lack of concern for a fellow person. They did everything in their power. They wanted to teach a lesson to Lot. They wanted to teach a lesson to the people that you do not have guests. That's against our principles. We don't treat people nicely. It's each man for himself. We are a selfish society. We don't share with others. That was the attitude of the people of Sodom, and they institutionalized that as practice of in the entire community. So this was Sodom. Here we don't see that. Here we don't have that kind of behavior. This was a group of people within the tribe of Binyamin that engaged in this behavior. Now what happens? They rape her, and when they're finished having their way with her, they leave her on the steps. And here's where we see the behavior of this Levite, that when the morning comes along, he takes her. The way it's described there wasn't even this particularly caring person. He doesn't look too disappointed. He just kind of takes her and throws her on the... She's dead. He just kind of throws her on his donkey and goes about his way. And then when he gets to wherever it was, he cuts her up into 12 pieces, which already is a shift a little bit in the story. In other words, he's cutting her up because he does see that what's taken place here is abominable, and wants to rally the troops around that. So that while that is really creepy and really, as my kids would say, and it's really like uncomfortable, but we can understand that. In other words, I as uncomfortable as it is to think about somebody's body being cut up, it's a dead person, and he's trying to make a point to the other tribes, and that's a real dramatic way, you know, to send an email, because they didn't have email back then. But it's not as uncomfortable even as him kind of getting up in the morning, seeing this concubine of his just lying on the steps and throwing her on the horse, you know, throwing her on his donkey and going about his way. So the people gather in 21, and they call for the tribe of Binyamin also. Now let's talk about this first from a political standpoint, or from a practical standpoint. What was going on here with the people of Binyamin? So the tribes, each tribe believed that they were responsible for their own people. So if there was a misbehavior within a tribe, it was the people of the tribe that were responsible to deal with it. And it was almost like the leaders of the tribe of Binyamin said, "Hey, this is not your problem. This is our problem. We're going to deal with it. This is a local matter." Right? This is a local matter. This isn't our responsibility. Now, one of the meanings behind the limbs that were sent around was a message that this Levite was trying to communicate to the other tribes, and that is that there is no such thing as a private matter. There's no such thing as a local matter when it comes to the Jewish people. We're part of one body. And if we have one part of the body that's atrophying, or that's got gangrena, if it's beyond salvation, it needs to be cut off. So where are we here? Are we in a situation where this tribe has gotten to a point where they're so low that we need to cut them out? Or is there hope for them? In either case, it's the Jewish people's collective responsibility to address this. And when they called for the leaders of Binyamin and they didn't come forth, that was a sign to the Jewish people that the people of Binyamin had, as a tribe, decayed to a point where they needed to be eliminated. Now, while all that may be accurate and true, there was fault in the leaders of the Jewish people. And the fault in the leaders of the Jewish people is twofold. Number one, they acted from a place of anger, and a place of hot-headedness. There was there's a balance in the prophet articulating how they gathered to paint the picture that this was not a mob mentality. It wasn't like they all went running out and, you know, just wreaked havoc. It was organized. They got together. They took counsel. They discussed it. But their zealousness got the better of them. They were too zealous in their behavior. And we see that from... Even though they had gone up to consult with the prophets, with the Kohen, and they consulted with what was known as the Urim V'Tumim, the breastplate and communicating with God. But they didn't ask if they should attack. What was their question? Who should go first? So God doesn't get in the way of people. You want to do harm, you can do harm. So who should go first? If you're asking who should go first, and any time you go first, Judah should go first. You didn't ask if they should go. You said who should go first. So Judah's going to go first. And when they went out, it was a terrible massacre. Many Jews got killed. Why? Because there was a combination of events that are coming together here. Number one, there's a punishment for the sin of Micha's idol that is finding its home now. It's finding a place to kind of find the punishment. We find that concept in the Talmud that there are times when there is a time of danger where God kind of capitalizes on that danger to deal with other things that maybe the time wasn't right. So we have this kind of decaying that's going on that is the responsibility of the other Jews. But it's also like you're going to take out this tribe. Are you really coming from a place of real sincerity? And because they weren't, so therefore they found that they were somewhat punished in this first round. There's so much detail here. Yes?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Mike, you might be able, or Lolly, you might be able to, or no, all of you might be able to help, because there's something we just recently did talking about this idea that there's certain things that the individual can do teshuvah for. It was with Torah study we were talking about. And then there are other times that the group has to do teshuvah. So.
I think we're in the context of sin offerings.
Was it? It was in the context. Yeah, it was in the context of sin offerings. I think it might have been for Vayikra. But anyway, I'm just wondering if that applies here. That you've got a group of, if these were isolated people in this tribe that had gone astray, did the whole tribe need to do teshuvah?
So the answer is that fundamentally no, but, and this is the point, that since, so there are a number of opinions as to whether the people that had sinned, were they the lowly parts of the tribe or were they the higher parts of the tribe, number one. But regardless, the fact that the leaders, it wasn't that the Jewish people weren't right in their assessment, that the leaders of the tribe of Benjamin had a responsibility to actually take care of their own, and they weren't doing that. They were almost kind of whitewashing it. Not that the whole tribe needs to do tshuva for things that individuals did, but they had to take responsibility to make sure that the punishment was taken care of. You can't allow for, when we live in a society that we allow people who are decaying society, it's the old parable of the guy who's sitting on the boat and is drilling a hole under his seat. And say, what are you doing? He said, well, it's under my seat. It's not going to affect. It's not your business. I paid for the seat. Right? Well, but you're going to take down the whole ship with you. You can't just stand by and watch that. You can't say it's just an isolated incident. It's not. It's not an isolated incident. It's society that can allow for... If society can allow an isolated incident to go unpunished, then society has a problem. If the tribe of Binyamin is letting that happen, and in fact, it's very interesting when I read these commentaries here, we actually find that in many ways the Jewish people were at a very high spiritual level. That they didn't let this incident go by is actually demonstrates their high moral standard. Right? We hear this story and it's an ugly story. But they didn't let them get away with it. Think about it. You have from all over the land of Israel, people hear this story and they say, we're not going to let something like this go unnoticed. We can't just say this is an isolated incident. Right? We live in a society today where these things happen every day. And we go about our business. Right? We open up the news in a given day and you read the terrible things that are going on, and then you close it and you go about your day, you forgot about what was even on the news in the morning. Think about it. We live in a society that we can let these things happen. Not that necessarily you and I can change that straight on, but we're so callous to it.
Doesn't just happen overnight. It's this gradual process that we then sort of take as being the norm.
Right.
And that's, I think, what you're referring to.
And if we don't stop it when it starts, it becomes much more difficult down the line, both because it becomes more commonplace in society and less we become desensitized to it. So the people are gathering here is a very lofty, it's a very noble, very moral, high moral standing. It doesn't mean it's above reproach. They did some things wrong here. And so, again, we have some interesting technical thing here going on here that the tribe of Binyamin, when they're attacked, they're now acting in self-defense. And by Jewish law, you're allowed to act in self-defense. So they're not responsible for that. But then we read in the text that after the Jews started fleeing, they chased them. So when they chase them, it's no longer self-defense. Now it's considered a pursuer. And when you're a pursuer and you kill people, now you're guilty of murder. So it's an interesting little twist that's going on here. So in the second day, when they realized that they had gone out without asking God's permission, and they asked God's permission the second day, in other words, they've repented for that, still there's 18,000 people that get killed. Why? Again, we have it's the end of the punishment for not asking the first time, and now there's still some fault in how they ask, because they're asking and saying, hey, should we go out? Yes, we should go out. Okay, we're just going to run with that, as opposed to saying God wants us to go out with a knowledge that it's His strength that's going to make us succeed. Our need to engage tactically, which they did in the third battle, but at the end of the day, it's God's power that's going to make us succeed. And ultimately, they did go out a third time. They were victorious the third time. And again, we have kind of this very uncomfortable outcome here. So they're victorious, and there are 600 men. They also wiped out the women and the children. And it was a really rough thing. Now there was one city that had not been wiped out. The women and the men of that city. Where is it here? Yeah, Yavesh Gilad. So. Okay, so Benjamin is practically wiped out. There are 600 men that were not killed, but they need women in order to be able to promulgate the tribe. And what we have here also is a fascinating event that's taking place. The Jewish people are crying over what they've done. This wasn't like this great celebration, hey, we got rid of this terrible part of our people. It's painful. This was something that we wish we hadn't happened. And now, because we took this oath, what's going to happen with our brother's tribe? And the leftovers of the tribe of Benjamin and the Jewish people kind of made peace. And now there's this extra sense of what happens to this tribe? Did we just lose a whole part of our people? So there's a city called Yavesh Gilad. The people there did not participate. They did not come up when they were supposed to. And again, this is also a little bit hard to swallow, but it's what it says. The people of Yavesh Gilad were supposed to join the people, and they hadn't. And therefore, they killed them. Where are we here? Yeah, so the people of Yavish Gilead had not come to battle with them. Yeah, there it is. So they went and killed the people of Yavish Gilead, and because what had happened was when the Sanhedrin instructs people to gather, it's an obligation to gather. And the people of this city of Yavish Gilead did not gather, and the Sanhedrin needed to make their point. This is also a harsh thing, harsh pill to swallow, but it's the reality, is that when you have lawlessness, it itself feeds on itself. So when you have a whole city that says, we're not coming, we're not listening, that doesn't work. That creates fracturing in a community, and they needed to act on that. So the leftover, so when they went to kill the people of Yavish Gilead, they said to them that they should kill all the married women. They intentionally didn't instruct them to kill all women, because they wanted that the virgin women should be saved, and that in turn they would give these virgin women to the children of Benjamin to help promulgate that tribe. Now, what happened? So there's 400 women of this city that are left. Now, they can't either tell them to go and marry the people of Binyamin, because they swore that they wouldn't give their daughters to the people of Binyamin. Right? So you have all these oaths and all the technicalities. So therefore, the people of Binyamin were instructed that when the women went out on the 15th of Av to celebrate, which was the practice, as we know, that the women would go out, they would switch clothing, the rich and the poor would, everybody would be dressed in white, and they would go out to the vineyards and they would dance there, and they would say, don't look at money, look at inner beauty, don't look at external beauty, and the men would go and they would pick a bride, right? And so there was this process. So now ultimately the fathers would have to approve and give their daughters, so to speak, in marriage. But in this case, they encouraged the fathers, and I'm not sure who the fathers were, if they were the leftovers of the city. So it could be that they lived there, it could be the fathers weren't. I don't know exactly what the context is of that, but that doesn't really say that here. But they encouraged the men to go, the men of Binyamin to go and take these women, and to encourage the fathers not to protest. But that only leaves us with 400. We still need 200 other women. And what do they do with the other 200 women? What happened with the other 200? Yeah. There's other meat things that I'm sorry. So the 400 women were taken by the 400 of the men. And they, yeah, so those are the 400 women. The remaining 200 men, so okay, let's clarify. So the 400 women that were preserved from this battle, those became designated, correct, they didn't have fathers, so they became designated for the men of Binyamin. No one gave these women, they were taken by the men of Binyamin. The 200 women that were taken by the last 200 men of Binyamin came from these celebrations. Now, the celebrations were there was something interesting that happened as part of the celebration, and that was, if you remember, we had spoken a number of times about different instances when there was an issue with marriage causing land to move out of one tribe into another. So there was a prohibition, and when the generation that entered into the land of Israel, that you weren't allowed to marry out of your tribe. That was abolished on the 15th of Av. And it was a day of celebration because it broke down those barriers between tribes. So when this celebration was taking place, there was that. It also had to do with the victory over the in the desert, when the decree of the generation that died in the desert came to an end, and they knew it had concluded actually on the 9th of Av, but they had confirmed it when they saw the moon was full that month. So 9th of Av, the moon is not entirely full, so they held their breath, so to speak, until the 15th of Av, and nobody had died for the subsequent evenings, and then they knew on the 15th of Av that the decree had come to an end. So it became a day of celebration. There's other events that took place, but regardless, what had became a tradition is that the women would dress and in white, and they would dance and so on, and thus it became a day of celebration. So while these celebrations were going on, they encouraged the remaining 200 men to go and take themselves wives, and so it was. Anyway, that closes out really probably one of the most painful chapters or painful stories of Jewish history. Again, the reason the story is told to us is for us to draw lessons. There's a number of lessons that we share tonight that we can draw from there. And the book closes out that everybody went from there to their own portion, and it restates that which kind of introduced these last chapters, that in those days there was no king in Israel. Each person did what was right in his eyes, to kind of close out, number one, how did these things happen? Because there was lawlessness. There was a lack of leadership. And it also sets the stage for what's about to begin in the book of Shmuel, that, again, if we see these stories as being stories that transpired after Shimshon in preparation, so to speak, for the era of Shmuel and Eli, we understand what's going on here. These are stories that beg for leadership. We need to get our act together. We need somebody to help keep the glue together, because otherwise these kinds of stories are going to happen again and again. So it's not the happiest note to end off the book of Judges, but it's been a good book, and we learned a lot together, and we're going to continue, God willing, soon with the book of Shmuel after Pesach, and we'll keep going. Questions?
Yeah, I have a question. First of all, I'll go back to Micha, because unless I miss something, Micha never did anything redeeming in his story. Is that correct?
Because redeeming for himself.
For himself, but you know, in the eyes of God, certainly not. And yet, why do people name their child?
That's interesting. I do believe. I do believe.